Good morning. Delighted to see you. Thank you for coming. We welcome everyone, all of you online and those of you here in the building. Let me encourage those of you who are online, if you can come to the building, come. We're not asking you to do something to jeopardize your health. But if you could come, if you're normally going out in the public to shop and to do other things, consider this as a good way to draw close to you, brethren, in order for us to remain strong during this pandemic. And so I would want to introduce our topic. We're going to continue in our study that we've been in the seven last sayings of Jesus from the cross. And we begin with our first slide. Seven sayings from the cross. For any philosophy of life to be effective, you have to deal with our most common fear, and that is death. It is said to be prepared to really live, you have to be prepared to die. Are we prepared to die? Godwin mentioned that we do not know when the end of time will come, when Jesus returns to receive his people. And so are we prepared? All of us know that we're going to die. That is, if we live long enough. It is just a matter of when. What did Jesus have to say about death when he faced it himself? I want to emphasize in this lesson that Jesus experienced death, the same death that you and I are going to experience eventually in our lives. This will be our seventh and final lesson taken from Jesus' last words from the cross. Again, it is intriguing to me that there are seven sayings from the cross, and often Jews expressed deeper insights and thoughts with numbers. Seven is the perfect number. Is he saying or suggesting to our minds that there is a deeper meaning to all of this? Is Christ saying, even as he's dying, this is the way to a full and complete life in Christ? Let us note and remember. Quickly, we'll go over the seven sayings. First, three requests. For others. Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. Remember that? Then today you shall be with me in paradise, he told the thief, one of the thieves. To his mother and to the disciple and apostle John, woman, behold your son, behold your mother. And then four requests for himself. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? I am thirsty. It is finished. Finally, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Let's read again our text and emphasize the part that we will speak about in this lesson. It was now about the sixth hour, that makes it 12 noon, and darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour, till 3 p.m. Because the sun was obscured. Wonder how that made people feel. All of a sudden it got dark at high noon. It stayed that way for 3 hours. And the veil of the temple was torn in two. What impression would that have for those priests who were serving in the temple to see that massive veil that would take multiple men to even lift, to rip from top to bottom. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what had happened, he began praising God, saying, certainly, This man was innocent. And all the crowds who came together for this spectacle, when they observed what had happened, began to return, I take it, return to their housing, beating their breasts. What does that mean? That was a Jewish way to show grief and anxiety and fear, beating their breasts. They were afraid. What an event. One that no one there would ever forget. We want to consider this last statement from the cross. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Jesus' last words focused on the fact about death. I want to emphasize it in our lesson. Jesus died actually, confidently, willingly, and victoriously. And so can we. We'll get to that towards the end. So let's begin. Jesus died actually. His death was not an illusion or a fictional historical creation. He died in a physical body. His physical body ceased. He ceased to breathe. His heart stopped. He was dead. Jesus had a real human body. In the first century, this was difficult for many people to accept. In our age, we have difficulty accepting that He was God. In their age, they had difficulty accepting that God would actually lower Himself and take on a physical body. Different mindset, a different way of looking at the world. But Jesus had a real human body. He was subject to the same sinless human frailties that we all have. Jesus could go hungry. He could lose sleep and be sleepless, suffer hot or cold, tired, weak, pain, sorrow, joy. Jesus experienced all of these things that are common to us living in a body. He suffered a real death, not a swoon or a coma to be later revived in a cool tomb. Note how the scriptures emphasize this. Pilate and the Roman soldiers checked carefully that he was dead. Then the Jews, because it was the day of preparation, so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Why would they break the legs? To quicken death. You see, you use your legs to push up so you could continue to breathe. Break the legs. And they suffocated on the cross more quickly. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man and the other who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Roman soldiers could know when a person was dead. They had practice. They had experience. But further, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus wrapped and buried the body of Jesus, and they knew he was dead. Note this from John 19:38-42. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate, and I've inserted in parentheses a statement made over in Mark, after he, Pilate, ascertained from the centurion that Jesus was dead. See, Pilate said, well, wait a minute, let me make sure he's dead. So he asked the centurion. And so knowing he was dead, he gave the body to Joseph of Arimathea, granted permission. So he came and took away his body. But then he's joined by Nicodemus. Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in a linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. You interlace the spices in the folds of the wrapping and you wrap that body. It would take a little while to accomplish that with 100 pounds of spices. These men could know whether or not Jesus was alive. He was dead. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb. Why emphasize that, John? New tomb. Well, when he comes out, or it's purported that he has come out, there wasn't any other body in there to come out. A new tomb. Nope. Nobody had ever been placed in that new tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. Therefore, because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was nearby, what does he mean? Well, the next day is the Sabbath, and they can't do it. The Jews bury their bodies immediately. That's the custom. So they picked a garden that was nearby. They laid Jesus there. But further, I want to speak briefly about the swoon theory. This theory surfaced and was proposed by skeptics and unbelievers beginning in the 18th and the 19th century. And believe it or not, it continues even today, especially by Islamic scholars. I was studying with a Muslim in my home several years ago, and I was absolutely kind of blown away that he did not believe that Jesus died. I thought he would struggle with Jesus was resurrected. But no. No, he didn't believe that Jesus died. Well, let's consider this. What is the Islamic swoon theory? Well, there is a Muslim cleric, Ahmed Didat of South Africa, and he wrote a book called Crucifixion or Crucifixion. He is asserting that the crucifixion is fallacy. It's fiction, something made up. And why would they do that? Hold on. I went to Wikipedia to see if I could get the Islamic position on crucifixion, and here's what I found. The Islamic position on the subject of crucifixion is highlighted in verse of the Quran. Quote, "And for their unbelief and their uttering against Mary, a mighty calumny, and for their saying, quote, we slew the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of God, yet they did not slay him, neither they killed him by crucifixion, only a confusion was made to them." They were confused. He didn't really die. The original theory says he just swooned or went into a brief or a very limited coma. In the coolness of the tomb, he revived and came out. Why would Islam take up this belief? Because they believe that all the prophets, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, are equal. You can see the point, can't you? A man who dies, he then is resurrected, sets himself apart from the others. And so I'm asserting the Bible teaches that Jesus actually died. It was not some physical sleep, but physical death. To this fact, the Bible is emphatically clear. Now, you could choose not to believe the Bible, but that's what the Bible teaches. He actually died. But further, not only did Jesus die actually, he died confidently. And what produced this confidence at death? I'm doing this because I want to suggest not only did Jesus die confidently, but we can too, in the same matter. No, he died confidently because of the Father's presence. The Father was with him. Jesus addressed his Father three times from the cross, praying to him, "Father, forgive them, they do not know what they're doing." He's addressing his Father. He's talking to his Father. And then, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He's addressing God. Further, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." Again, he is talking to his Father. He's taking advantage of the close relationship or presence of the Father with him. The Father's presence was always with Jesus. It was a continuing, close, dependent relationship with his Father. And he challenges and offers to us the same relationship to our Father that he had to his through him, through our forgiveness of sins. At 12, he said, "I must be about my Father's business." Let's teach our children to quickly understand to be about their Father's business, our Father's business, from a youth. The Sermon on the Mount, he used Father more than 15 times. He taught us to pray, "Our Father, which art in heaven." He continually prayed to his Father and taught his disciples to do the same. So two occasions, I believe, he prayed all night for the presence of his Father. And at the end of his life, he confidently prayed because his Father was with him. And our Father will be with us as well. But further, we could confidently be confident about death because of the Father's promise. And so he was. Jesus lived and died by the Father's promise. All three of his prayers on the cross are tied to scriptural prophecies and promises. "Father, forgive them, they do not know what they're doing," is tied to Isaiah 53:12. He interceded for the transgressors. Jesus applied that to himself, a statement made by David in Isaiah 53. And then the prayer, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Psalm 22:1. David uttered this very phrase. And now this one, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." He is quoting and using and applying it to himself, Psalms 31:5. "Into your hand I commit my spirit," David wrote. It said, "You have ransomed me, O Lord, God of truth." Jesus said, "I'm in that situation too." And so of the Father's presence, he is there. Like David, who trusted in the promise of God to rescue him, so Jesus trusted in his Father to receive his Spirit to a place of safekeeping. In like manner, the only assurance we have is the Word of God. Let us live by His Word so that we can die by His Word. And be confident in that because of His presence. But further, He was confident because of the Father's protection. From His birth, Jesus was in the hands of men and subject to their evil desires and efforts as a baby. Herod tried to kill him. beginning his ministry, he goes into the wilderness. And Satan tempted him to abandon his father and follow him. He was under constant pressure and intrigue from his enemies to trap and discredit him, even to kill him. He was always subject to the hands of evil men. He tried to prepare his disciples for the cross. Look what he said. And while they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." In other words, he's going to submit himself now to that which he has been avoiding and preventing up until this point. "But I'm going to put myself into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were deeply grieved. I doubt that they even heard that last phrase. Raised on the third day. And note this statement that he makes in Matthew 23, verse 45. This is in the Garden of Gethsemane. "Then he came to the disciples and said to them," this is Peter, James, and John in the garden, "are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners." From that point on, till this final moment, Jesus was in the hands of sinners. They bound him and arrested him. They stripped him and beat him. They crowned him with a crown of thorns. And then they nailed him to a cross. He was in the hands, though, of his Father. Throughout his life, he had entrusted himself to the Father's will, even as it meant to be mistreated by men. Just because he was being mistreated does not mean that the Father had abandoned him. He trusted in his protection to accomplish his mission. Remember, he kept saying in various ways, even from the wedding feast at Cana at the beginning of his ministry, "My hour has not yet come. It's not ready. It's not time." But now his hour has come. From Psalm 31 again, verse 8 and then verse 15. "And you have not given me over into the hand of the enemy," David writes. "You have set my feet in a large place." Good place. Large here is for good. Spacious. Verse 15. "My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and from those who persecute me." As he had entrusted himself to the Father's will in his life, he now in his death commits his spirit to his Father. And then his death demonstrates that he did it willingly. Willingly. Wicked men murdered Jesus. Peter proclaimed approximately 50 days later, this statement: "This man, Jesus, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God." This didn't catch God by surprise. This was according to God's will. "You, nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men, had put him to death." You're guilty of that. But Jesus willingly died. He allowed them to do it. Never forget that. John 10:17-18. Jesus speaking, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I receive from my Father." As we sang just a few moments ago, He could have called 10,000 angels. But He willingly gave up His life for us. Jesus, before He died willingly, look what He did. He forgave His enemies. He gave salvation to a repentant thief. He cared and provided for His mother. And He finished His work. May I suggest humbly that each of us should set our purpose in life to follow the Father's will, so that by the time of our death, we have forgiven our enemies. That we've told others of salvation. That we have cared and provided for others. And that we have finished our work. And then finally, Jesus died victoriously. Often it is difficult for us to see that a young man, Jesus was a young man, we think 33, 34, and even in that day, when they didn't live as long as a lot of people live today, he was still considered young. He was in the prime of his life. I would suspect that most of us would consider that a failure, to die so young. But Jesus died victoriously. Look at the statement from Luke 23 again, verse 46. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, not a whimper, not a whine, not a soft expression of defeat and resignation. No, with a loud voice, he said, and I'd almost scream it if y'all wouldn't jump out of the pew, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Confident, victorious. Having said this, he breathed his last. It was a cry of victory, not defeat. When he said, it is finished, he's not saying, I'm finished, meaning I'm defeated. No, I have completed the work for which I was sent into the world. A cry of victory, not defeat. And then I believe there were at least two confirming miracles, possibly even three, to confirm the victorious nature of this, what Jesus had done on the cross. Confirming miracles. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. What does that signify? It signifies that the entrance into the very presence of a holy God is now available to sinful men and women because they could be forgiven. The veil of the temple separated the high priest who could go into the Holy of Holies from everyone else. But now all can come into the presence of God. And note further, and the earth shook and the rocks were split by God's command. The tombs were opened and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. They, loved ones who had died before, saints, were now back with their families. The earthquake reminds us of the earthquake at Mount Sinai, does it not? When God came down to give the law, the people were absolutely terrified at the voice of God and just begged Moses, Moses, you go meet with him. We're too terrified to be in the presence of God. But now we have something to praise and cheer victoriously, for the law has been fulfilled. and forgiveness of sin, which the law could never give, is offered to all mankind. And it is witnessed by again an earthquake. And so, as we come to a close, note the reactions of people that day to these cataclysmic events. From Luke 23, 46 through 47 again, and Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what had happened, he began what? Praising God, saying, "Certainly this man was innocent." And further, from Matthew's account, 27:54. Now the centurion and those who were with him, keeping guard over Jesus, the other soldiers, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, became very frightened and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And then what about the crowds who were there? And all the crowds who came together for this spectacle, when they observed what had happened, began to return, beating their breasts, terrified. And all of his acquaintances and the women who accompanied him, Jesus, from Galilee, were standing at a distance, seeing these things. We, like the women who accompanied him from Galilee, are seeing these things. They in person. We by reading. We're seeing this. This historical account of what happened. Well, Will we be like the crowds who went away in fear, beating their breasts? Does this message cause us to have consternation and anxiety about our eventual and coming death? Or are we more like the Roman soldiers who say, "Truly, this is the Son of God"? And so we conclude with two questions. Have we committed our lives to the Father's will? "Thy will be done, whatever it is, Lord." Have we? At last, at death, will we be able to commit our spirits to Him? You see how the two are related one to the other? One will not be able to commit your spirit to Him if you have not committed your spirit to Him while you live. We do not know the time or the hour. But let us see the joy and comfort and confidence that comes from living by the will of the Father. If we can help you in any way to express your desire to obey the Father, then we would be delighted to do so. Let's stand and let us sing.